Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It is Monday. Brace yourself. You kind of knew that this Monday was going to be a little bit rocky looking at some of the stock market futures, but oh my God, the stock market had to pause, the Dow had to pause trading, not the Dow, but the stock market had to stop trading after it hit a circuit breaker, dropping 7% in the first few minutes. This would suggest that despite the president's efforts to calm the public and the market, to suggest that it's no big deal, despite Hugh Hewitt tweeting out this was all Trump derangement syndrome, that neither the public nor the markets are particularly, shall we say, mollified. So joining us this morning is the National Journal's Josh Kroshauer. Good to talk with you, Josh.
Good afternoon, Charlie, and it's good to talk on a very tumultuous day, both in the economy and in our broader political landscape.
You haven't looked at your 401k yet this morning, right? Just don't do it today.
Don't check it. Don't look.
You know, a couple of things. Now, by the way, I told you before we started this, I've been thinking about your piece all weekend where you talk about what a difference one week has made, the complete turnaround in the political prospects and what it means for the Senate and the renewal of Democratic optimism. But let's just start before we get to that. And of course, we're going to talk about Michigan tomorrow. And whether that's going to be Bernie's last stand, I'm going to ask both those questions. But let's just talk about what really remarkable to me that Donald Trump really has bet his entire presidency on the handling of the coronavirus. And, you know, normal game theory would be that you hedge your bets, right? You say you hope for the best, but you prepare for the worst. You get out of the way. You let the experts handle this. And yet the president just seems to be flailing around. And I've been trying to add up the number of, you know, great job, brownie moments, mission accomplished moments for this administration. But this is something that Donald Trump has never faced before. This does strike me as something new in this presidency. This is a reality check he can't tweet away.
This is a facts matter moment for the presidency, and you can't spin, you can't deny away the reality of the spread of the coronavirus and the public health consequences to come, given Trump's own advisors' warnings. It's just remarkable to contrast what the president is saying with what his own top public health advisors, with what some of the leading experts in the field are talking about. And I'm just watching his Twitter feed just in the last hour. And you have a tweet where he says, "Good for the consumer, gasoline prices coming down." I mean, this is the bubble that the president is currently occupying, and unlike past crises that he's faced, and he's faced quite a few, this is one that effectively directs many people that are worried about contracting the coronavirus. This is not something you can spin away. And, you know, this might be sort of this Fifth Avenue moment. You know, the president famously said during the 2016 campaign that, you know, he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and his supporters wouldn't care. At CPAC, his now former chief of staff, Mick Mulvaney, was sort of denying that the coronavirus was a serious threat. It was a media manufacturer type of story. That's not the case. And now people at CPAC, including the head of CPAC, shook a hand of someone who was infected with the coronavirus. So this kind of, we've talked a lot about this sort of alternate reality shield that's protected the president and some of his advisors. That has been penetrated at CPAC directly, and the politics are changing rapidly, and the president still, as of Monday, doesn't seem to realize how much of a crisis that the country currently faces.
Yeah, the whole CPAC story, I mean, if irony hadn't been beaten to death by hammers a long time ago, that would be an ironic moment after they were mocking the severity of it. Now we find out that attendees had in fact been exposed to all of it. And, you know, this is the danger, though. I mean, like guys like Matt Gaetz, who, you know, shows up on the floor of the House of Representatives wearing that big, dumb-looking gas mask, you know, making light of the coronavirus, and then within a few days has to announce that one of his constituents died of this. So this is the danger when you go out and you plant the flag, you stake all of this on, you know, it's Trump derangement syndrome, et cetera. You mentioned something that I think is crucial here, the penetration of this alternative reality shield, because it strikes me that this is different. And I know we've said that before, but wherever you go, people are talking about this. This is not some esoteric thing that people within the Beltway are talking about that the public and, you know, in bars and taverns and George Webb restaurants are not talking about. Everybody with children is talking about this. Everybody with elderly parents is talking about this. Anybody who travels talks about this. It's impacting daily life in the service economy. So that makes it very, very different. The other thing is that Trump has really counted on this kaleidoscopic news cycle and being able to change the subject. This is not going away. I mean, we've gotten used to, Josh, big stories that last for 24 hours and then you forget about 2 days later. This one has been hanging around a long time, and you know that it's going to get bigger and worse because we haven't done the testing, and inevitably the numbers are going to spike, and whether or not it's really getting worse, it's going to feel that it's getting worse.
Yeah, Charlie, the conversation throughout Trump's presidency amongst kind of the smart set on the Republican side has always been, well, what if there's a real crisis? How will the president react if there's a genuine, whether a terrorist attack or something that really requires full-on presidential leadership? And we've had some moments sort of in the lower level of that scale, but this is the first real test of a presidency, the first test where a president and the competence of his administration makes a real difference. And, a lot of the other big-time controversies, scandals, haven't necessarily impacted the average voter. Ukraine, I mean, that was a huge, national security crisis, but it did. Your average voter who cares more about their day-to-day lives, the quality of their lives, the cost of health care, that wasn't penetrating, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat. This on a much greater scale does. And I look, it's not all about politics. Public health is first and foremost, but I've got to think this may be the one thing that can kind of penetrate the partisanship and tribalism we've seen in Washington. And
you're seeing these polls showing that Republicans don't take the disease as seriously as Democrats. So this mindless tribalism actually now poses a real threat to public health, potentially.
A very, very, very serious threat to public health, and I think the public is waking up to that in the last couple of days. But also just from a political standpoint, we were talking a few weeks ago that with the economy booming, and everything that at the macroeconomic levels was going right for the president, he still was ahead slightly, but you don't have any room for error. So even if you take a kind of best case political view for the Republican Party and for Trump, and you still think people are kind of stuck in their tribal zones, even a small hit makes a huge difference, and especially now that the Democrats are poised to nominate a non-socialist to the ticket, all of a sudden the Republican fortunes have gone from looking pretty decent
dramatic
a few weeks ago to in a chaotic red flag type scenario, which I don't think they ever could have imagined a month ago.
I was talking with a smart guy on Friday, and we were talking about whether this could be Trump's Katrina, and his point was this could be much, much worse than Katrina, because Katrina at least was isolated. It was down there. It was quote unquote those people. This is everybody. And so, and the record, and the documentation of the screw ups, the incompetence, every day we get another sign of it. And then of course it keeps going, the White House overruling health officials who wanted to warn elderly and physically fragile Americans against traveling. All of that. And then the president's just thoroughly shambolic, appearance at the CDC, which sort of dwarfs anything that George Bush did with mission accomplished. So let's talk about this, the change of fortune. Because, maybe we need to get used to this sort of whiplash, but it feels like 2 weeks ago, Democrats were gloom and doom that everything was at risk. Donald Trump was riding high. He was having the best week of his presidency. He had been acquitted. The stock market was high. The jobless rates were falling. Everything was going his way. Democrats looked incredibly incompetent in Iowa. Looked like they were actually going to be nominating this cranky Democratic socialist. You could just feel the giddiness among Republicans and the real depression that was spreading among Democrats. And oh my God, Josh, it feels like in just a few days, the moods have completely turned around. Let's talk about that. What's changed?
Well, let's start with what happened right before right after the South Carolina election, where the adults in the Democratic Party got their acts together, and you know, from Pete Buttigieg to Amy Klobuchar, they realized that, you know, in a time of immense importance, they can't afford to have someone who is an extremist at the top of their ticket, in addition to what to the having the president being on the ballot at the same time. So, you know, there was a moment which you didn't see in the Republican Party in 2016, where you had candidates who probably didn't have much of a chance of winning the nomination dropping out, endorsing the more mainstream candidate in Joe Biden, and he won by a much bigger than expected margin on Super Tuesday, and you know, sort of prevented the worst case scenario from happening to the Democratic Party like it did to the Republican Party just 4 years ago. Look, that sort of changed the overall political landscape, not just at the presidential level, but down ballot, where now, you know, I wrote a column about the Senate landscape, and you know, I think the Senate is where, you know, the prospect of a Bernie Sanders, the prospect of someone extreme at the top of the ticket, really would have hurt the Democratic Party substantially. And now with Biden at the top of the ticket, there's a new wave of polls showing Democrats leading in at least four of the biggest contests. So the political environment, even in some Republican-leaning states, has turned. And this is before the coronavirus crisis has enveloped the Trump administration. And again, I've got to imagine, you got to imagine things are not going to get any better, especially the way the president is reacting to the growing crisis in the country. And this is I talked to a few Republicans over the weekend who were, you know, frankly, in a state of panic, not just at the president's behavior and his inability to understand the gravity that this moment requires, but at the risk that the political consequences could get much, much worse, that a party that has tied itself entirely to President Trump is really at risk of reaping some pretty bad consequences in the 2020 election.
You had this paragraph. I'm going to read you your own stuff from your column. Republican candidates have tied themselves so closely to Trump that they are all dependent on his fortunes. That's a risky place to be right now. Last month, the economy was booming and a socialist was on track to lead the Democratic ticket. This month, the stock market is falling, coronavirus is spreading, and a mainstream Democrat is positioned to become the presidential nominee. Trump's reelection chances have suddenly taken a turn for the worse, and he's threatening to take down the GOP Senate majority with him. And no sooner did you write that than we get the news out of Montana that the governor, popular Democratic governor Steve Bullock, is getting into that state Senate race, which then now makes this competitive. You know, otherwise, you know, Republican incumbent Steve Daines probably would have cruised to an easy reelection. Now this thing is, you know, is a red dot on the map.
Yeah, Steve Bullock would not have gotten in the race if it wasn't for Biden moving ahead significantly in the nomination fight. I mean, he was putting off this decision, saying he wasn't going to run for a long, long time. But I've got to think that the change in political mood just in the last week made the final decision for him. Now, I still think that's a tough race for Montana. Still a pretty Republican state. It's a tough state for any Democrat to win, but the race is going to be in play. There's going to be money that Republicans are going to have to spend in a Republican state like Montana. And look, the reality is there are already enough states, as I pointed out in the column, on the board where Republican senators are losing already in the polls that would be enough to give Democrats the majority, at least a 50-50 tie, and if Biden got elected, to break that tie. But no, you have states like Georgia, states like Kansas, Montana, that are, you know, those are reach states, so they're states that Republicans should be able to hold on to. But at this point, those are looking like icing on the cake. Those are looking like the seats that if they won any one of those, they would be on the majority. They'd actually be able to expand a majority. So you don't want to get too far ahead of yourself, but you don't want to be in
a
March,
big year. Yeah.
8 months before an election, and you have Republican senators already, people who, against candidates, keep in mind, who people don't really know about. Their numbers are likely to improve as people get to hear about these Democratic challengers. And you have Republican incumbents from Susan Collins to Martha McSally who are polling in the low 40s, who are polling much worse than they ever have. And that's just not a good place to be in, especially before the aftermath, the political aftermath, at least, of the coronavirus and the president's handling of it to really take shape.
So you mentioned the four states with Republican incumbents where they're underwater. Those four states are North Carolina.
Colorado with Cory Gardner. He's dead. Arizona, Martha McSally. North Carolina with Tom Tillis, who just found out who his opponent's going to be. And you've got the big race of all, Susan Collins in Maine, who one poll over the last week showed her with a 33% job approval rating, which is unlike anything you've ever heard. I mean, that's not even close to anything that Susan Collins has traditionally been able to produce. She's always been a pretty bipartisan figure in Maine. But since her vote on impeachment, her numbers have really taken a dive in Maine.
I want to get to what's going to happen tomorrow, what I've called the coming Bernie apocalypse. But before we do this, can Trump pivot on this? I know pivot's become a kind of a joke, but you know, given the impact on the economy, he understands the importance of the stock market, and he understands that his reelection depends on a healthy economy. So there are reports today that he's going to be presented with options for paid leave, for some sort of tax relief, for businesses that are affected, some form of stimulus. Democrats support many of those. Do you think there's a prospect that you might actually have some bipartisan coming together on proposals like that?
You know, maybe. I think the president's playbook, if there's any sustained plan, would be to play politics, to blame Democrats, to blame China, to really play the blame game when it comes to dealing with this crisis. But boy, I mean, I just look at the fundamentals of politics, Charlie. And, you know, it's one thing it's easier to be in the opposition and throw spitballs at whoever's in power and to lay blame. The blame in any crisis, the burden for any crisis is on the incumbent party, on the party in power, on the party in the presidency. So, I mean, I just think Trump is really stuck here. You know, I don't think there are many good options for this White House. The best option is to project competence, to show that they can get things done. I don't see any signs, as you raise, that suggest that this White House is up for the task.
So you sort of made reference to something that I was theorizing about, and of course we don't know which way he's going to go on all of this, but Ezra Klein did tweet out that he thought, well, you know, he's going to make this pivot to go back to his playbook, which is, of course, you know, sort of xenophobia, nationalist. And I kind of was thinking along the same line. You could certainly imagine him going to an America First, you know, much more draconian travel bans, because, of course, that's how he really launched his campaign, you know, blaming the Chinese, blaming the Mexicans, you know, those people coming in here, bringing the diseases. And he's standing at the border, building walls, protecting the country, and looking for scapegoats. That would be a fundamental sort of Trumpian move, just like the demagoguing about the caravans did before the 2018. So could he pivot to make coronavirus the caravan that is coming for you and that I am protecting you from, that equivalent in 2020? Or is it too late for him now?
The problem is the virus is already in the country. I mean, I think he tried to do that initially many folks have given him credit for, you know, banning or restricting travel when the virus was first breaking out in China. And as many experts have said, that may have bought him a few weeks extra time to actually prepare for a credible response and come up with plans to test people, to identify the problems and to prepare for what's to come. But none of that happened. In fact, there's been plenty of good reporting over the last couple of days that the administration was totally asleep at the wheel, even as they had a few weeks time to really prepare a coherent response. So I you know, what are you going to do? Like, what's the nativist response now that the virus is in the country and spreading fast? What Northern Italy is doing, quarantining large parts of that country, I it's hard to see that happening here. And it's, frankly, even if that was done in the United States, it would be hard to see the president not getting a pretty significant political blowback.
I tend to agree with you. And let's just, for the sake of argument, let's say that the virus is not spreading rapidly. It probably is, but let's say it's not spreading rapidly. It will look like it's spreading rapidly as the testing increases. So by downplaying the numbers the way he has, he really has set up the markets and the public to think, whoa, my goodness, these numbers have just gotten dramatically worse. Look at his tweet this morning while he's trying to reassure a sliding stock market. I'm going to read his tweet. So last year, 37,000 Americans died from the common flu. It averages between 27,000 and 70,000 per year. Nothing is shut down. Life and the economy go on. At this moment, there are 546 confirmed cases of coronavirus with 22 deaths. Think about that! Exclamation point. Whoa, that is not going to age well. Okay, let's switch gears here. I want to talk about the coming Bernie apocalypse. It's really interesting. You're talking about the change in mood in the Democratic Party. It's like it feels like every 15 minutes or so, another leading Democrat endorses Joe Biden. You had Cory Booker do it this morning. Kamala Harris did it over the weekend. There seems to be a rallying around, but this also seems to be reflecting what's going on in the polls. So let's talk about Michigan. Oh, first of all, so CNN's out with a national poll today, showing Biden with a really impressive double-digit lead over Sanders, 52-36. Some of these state-by-state polls are just brutal in Florida. But let's talk about tomorrow and Michigan. Michigan is an absolute must-win state for Bernie Sanders, isn't it?
Yeah, and I don't think there's any sign that he's doing very well there. He hasn't changed his shtick, which is play to the far left of the party, get the same activists, get Rashida Tlaib to campaign for him in the final couple days. He's not expanded his appeal. You mentioned all the endorsements Joe Biden has received in the last few weeks, and Sanders has gotten endorsements from like Jesse Jackson Sr., and I guess Tlaib has been his lead surrogate at a lot of these events. This is not how you expand your appeal. And one thing that we've seen in the polls from Michigan, and as well as some of the results from the Super Tuesday states, is that white working class voters have actually rejected Sanders this time around, whereas in 2016, there was a lot of rallying around Sanders among white working class voters. I think maybe in hindsight, more as an anti-Clinton reaction than a pro-Sanders movement. But what we're seeing this time around is the same voters, the same working class union voters that make up such a big share of the electorate in Michigan are moving very much towards Joe Biden. They like Joe Biden a whole lot more. The poll showed 20-plus point leads for the former vice president. There was a poll in Arizona that was done this past week that also shows Biden leading by like 30 plus points with Hispanic voters and winning overall that state by a sizable margin. So, I mean, this race almost, I mean, we have to wait for the results to be counted, but Sanders is actually showing signs of losing support, losing momentum after Super Tuesday, and is likely to get crushed in a state like Michigan.
Well, you know that you have some landslide victories for Biden coming up. You have places like, you know, Mississippi tomorrow, Florida next week, Georgia. Those are pretty much baked in. And over the weekend, we had Steve Kornacki on from NBC, and he was walking through the delegate numbers and pointing out that even if Sanders managed to win narrowly in places like Washington State and Michigan, he would have a hell of a hard time catching up on the delegate count. But to actually lose Michigan or lose Michigan by double digit, it's devastating. So here's my question for you, Josh. If in fact these polls are accurate and there's been a long track record of Michigan polls missing it. I mean, we've been wrong before, right? So we need to like have all those caveats. If in fact Bernie gets crushed in Michigan of all places tomorrow, his campaign is effectively over, correct?
It is.
Okay.
And frankly, you know, with these endorsements coming in fast and furious, I think the race was functionally over after Super Tuesday.
I agree.
It was clear that, I mean, we were expecting, and I heard Steve on the show last week, and it was pretty insightful when it comes to the delegate map.
Yeah,
he knows that better than anyone else. You know, we were all talking about a best case scenario being essentially a tie, maybe Biden being down by 10, 20 delegates. He's up by 77 delegates as of today, as of the count, and we're still counting some of the delegates he left in Super Tuesday. That because of the proportional system that Democrats use and because of the clear shellacking that Sanders took, it's looking at that momentum is translated into these next wave of states. So even, as you point out, Charlie, even if Biden narrowly loses Michigan, it's just really hard for him to lose his lead in the delegate count because of, you know, and Steve probably said it better than I can, but, you know, Mississippi, which has about 30-some delegates, if you win 70-30 in a state like Mississippi, which is a conservative estimate for a very heavily African-American state like that, That's going to give you a big haul, a much bigger spread and a delegate advantage than winning narrowly in a bigger state like Michigan.
So here's here's the really tough question, though, that, you know, we agree. I think everybody sees that, that Sanders would be dead man walking if he loses by a big margin in Michigan, because the entire rationale of his campaign, of course, is that he's going to bring out this, this increase in voters, which he hasn't done. He's going to win in blue collar states like Michigan, which if he loses that, that, you know, knocks that peg out. But given the nature of Bernie's campaign, the cultic nature of his campaign, is he going to be able to drop out? You know, last time, of course, he stayed in against Hillary till the bitter end. I think it would be extremely difficult for him to make the calculation that every other candidate would make, that there's no path to the nomination. And that even though it would be effectively over, I would see that Bernie, you know, would be more than willing to maintain a zombie campaign at least through the end of the month.
I'll take the opposite view.
Okay.
And here's why. And I've been listening. Sanders has been doing quite a few interviews over the last week, and I've been struck actually by his tone, which is, I think has been more conciliatory to the to Biden. Every interview he likes to say that Joe's a good friend of his, and he's also, I think, in a few interviews has made the point that if he doesn't have a path to winning a plurality of the delegates, he's not going to extend this thing out. You know, Bernie Sanders supporters, I think, are more dug in to him than Sanders himself is. If you remember, in 2016, Sanders looked like he was done until Michigan, and then he had this remarkable come from behind victory in Michigan, and that really is what fueled his desire to keep on fighting. He had some other successes even late in the calendar against Hillary Clinton, to the point where he thought he wanted to prove that his movement had viability and had momentum and had support within the party. I think what's more likely to happen this time around, Charlie, is that he's going to get crushed, lose badly in a state like Michigan. I don't think those polls are off. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think it's possible he could lose by a larger margin than 20 points. And if he loses in Michigan, if he loses in Washington State, by the way, which had a caucus in 2016, but it's one he won by like 40, 50 points, the polls show Washington State is an awfully close election, and that is one of the biggest Bernie Sanders strongholds in the entire country right now. So I think if the results show Sanders losing badly and losing across the board in all these contests, I actually don't think he's going to stretch this thing out. I also think that he understands, like a lot of other Democrats do, that it's different in 2020 with President Trump being the opponent. I do think that there is some of that Trump effect even affecting Sanders folks and Sanders himself. So look, and also you also look at the map going forwards. You've got Georgia on March 24th.
Yeah.
You've got Florida on March 17th. Those are states where Sanders is likely to lose also by very sizable margins. So the question is, does he want to be embarrassed? Does he want to, if he wants his movement to be viable going forward, being beaten by 30, 40 points in state after state after state isn't the way to do it. And I think even he's enough of a political pragmatist, enough of one to understand that.
Even though there is sort of an alternative reality in Bernie world as well. And I guess I was struck by how he reacted by going hard negative against Biden, at least for a while, in public, going after him on the trade deals, going after him on, you know, claiming that he was going to cut Social Security, which didn't strike me as a particularly credible line of argument. And then, of course, you have this weird confluence, this weird convergence of Trump world and Bernie world, putting out the line that Joe Biden is basically senile, that he's suffering from cognitive decline. And it got so heated over the weekend that the Bernie campaign actually had to issue a statement saying, you know, these talking points, they're not really from us, but clearly virtually every single Bernie bro in the world was pushing out stuff about Joe Biden completely losing it, including these heavily doctored videos. So what do you make of that?
Well, this is where I think you have to separate the candidate from his followers, at least when it comes to what is he going to do if he loses badly. Yeah, I do think Sanders is understands politics, and there was a new poll, by the way, out today showing him losing by 41 points in Michigan. I mean, and that, if that pattern holds, he doesn't want to be embarrassed. Target Insight, which does its fair share of polling in Michigan, has Biden at 65%, Sanders at 24%. So again, I think those 20-point margins actually may be understated in Michigan because of the momentum is totally with the Biden campaign, and he's having a big rally in Detroit Monday night with Cory Booker and Kamala Harris. He's really trying to run up the score in Michigan. So I just think that I agree with you, Charlie, that the hardcore Kool-Aid drinkers that support Bernie aren't going to all of a sudden go kumbaya to Joe Biden and all of a sudden say, what can I do to help the Biden campaign? It's not going to happen, and there's going to be a lot of sour grapes. But I actually think Sanders is a little more of a political. He understands politics more than his followers do, and he's not going to want to. This is his last time ever running for president. I don't think he can run at age 83 in 4 years. So, you know, he's not going to want to be crushed by massive margins against Joe Biden in state after state after state. I think there's going to be some degree of pragmatism that, you know, as long as he loses by the margin that some polls suggest he will lose by, he's going to want to bow out gracefully and not extend this and create a bitter civil war within the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I don't think anybody had the over-under that the race would be effectively over now. I mean, remember, it seems like 5 minutes ago we were talking about the prospects for a brokered convention here in Milwaukee. So I assume this means we're going to be hearing a lot more about Hunter Biden.
I think we'll hear a lot more about Hunter Biden. I think we'll hear a lot more about Joe Biden's brother, who there's some ethical questions about business deals that he's done. The Oppo book is going to come out. So, you know, one of the negatives about kind of, you know, essentially being impeached out of your pursuit for dirt on Hunter Biden is that a lot of the stuff is baked in the cake.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask
for the former
next.
Vice president. People know. I mean, people know that about his son. People know about the ethically shady deal with Burisma that he worked up. And you know, I think for better or for worse, we kind of that's part of the Biden image at this point. I don't think there's a whole lot positive or negative that could really change those numbers.
It also looked so transparent when my good friend Ron Johnson from Wisconsin announced that he was going to, you know, issue subpoenas for Hunter Biden. He was going to pursue some of these conspiracy theories down some pretty dark rabbit holes. And in fact, the very day that story broke, he was actually on the same program as Don Jr., in crucial Waukesha County. They had the Lincoln Reagan Day dinner, and both Johnson and Don Jr. were on the, you know, what, again, that's just kind of creepy. But also, I think there's this moment where if you're the chairman of the Senate Government Oversight Committee, are you going to be what percent of your time do you want to spend on a Hunter Biden investigation as opposed to oversight of the federal government's response to coronavirus? And all of the implications for, you know, government programs and the economy of something like that. That's, again, going back to our original point. Here you have the reality check where you have a real problem that you cannot ignore, and it will look even more petty in contrast to that.
Yeah, I think that's right. And honestly, I don't – I mean, look, if we're dealing with coronavirus for the rest of the year – the stuff about Biden and Burisma seems
right.
Downright trivial.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I mean,
it seems like that's ancient history. You know, yeah, and that,
no
it didn't move the numbers dramatically when it came up and it was part of the impeachment trial. And I think at this point it's barely going to merit an asterisk if we're still talking about America's being protected and what the response is going to be from the government in response to spreading coronavirus. So. You know, I do think that we kind of lived in silly season for 3 years. You know, we lived in sort of the Trump world where everything, you know, alternative facts, and we kind of had a response to everything. Well, you know, you can't do that with a virus. And I feel like a lot of the stories that generated, you know, top billing on cable news are going to all of a sudden take a serious backseat to what this government is doing in response to mitigating and preventing the spread of coronavirus.
Yeah, who knew that reality would come back with such a vengeance? Josh Kroshauer, thank you so much for spending some time with us on a really, really rocky Monday, although they all felt a little bit rocky lately. But I really wanted to talk with you after reading your piece about just the incredible turnaround in mood. I'm trying to remember the last time, you know, a week ago we were talking about when was the last time you had anyone who made a political comeback as dramatic as Joe Biden, but also the way this has just changed the entire political environment. And you know that Mitch McConnell is watching all of this, and suddenly the prospects for his future, I think, have become rather significantly change in an incredibly short period of time. So again, thank you, Josh, for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark podcast. By the way, we announced over the weekend that we had hit 10 million downloads since inception. I really want to thank all of our guests and all of our subscribers. And if you like what we're doing, spread the word, go on iTunes, give us a good review. And just remember that we're going to have one heck of a year ahead of us. So we're going to be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.